Back if you've been here before to Finding Balance in a World of Extremes, and if this is your first time, welcome to Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. Before we get underway, I have both, I guess, the unfortunate and fortunate news to tell you that all of the books that the bookstore ordered are gone. So in the first 3 days. Which wasn't all that swift planning, but I guess on the other hand, they don't like to get a whole bunch of books in and then be stuck with them or else have to return them to the publisher. And so because a number of people have expressed some concern about that, what I think I will do is I brought one copy of my own along and just keep those and let folk look at them, browse through them at your convenience, and if you want to buy one, there's a sign-up sheet here with all the information on it, and we'll ship them to you as soon as we get back to Minneapolis. That's the best way I know to go. So feel free to take a look at them. They're up here after we're finished.
Do we have copies in the library for those of us?
You know, I don't know. I'll make it my business to look and see.
I appreciate that.
And then I'll let you know. Yeah, I should have done that, but I didn't get around to it. We can roll a tape because we're officially underway now. My name is Bill Miller, and this is a course whose overall theme is, as I mentioned, Finding Balance in a World of Extremes. And today, the fourth in the series, the title is Evaluating Values, and we look at how to find a balance between absolutism and amorality in what you believe and stand for. This theme, just again in a 2 or 3 minute review for those of you who come in for the first time today, this theme comes out of the observation that we often realize that we do live in a culture where most of us live in or very close to an extreme. Often we know very little of moderation, even though we would be the very first ones to scream and shout and holler and say, hey, wait a minute, we are moderate people. But we rarely realize that we're in or close to an extreme until something happens, maybe some tragedy or some catastrophe or some intervention, and then all of a sudden we realize how lopsided our lives have been, and we haven't had a sense of balance, or we haven't been pursuing some kind of a mid-path between these extremes. My contention is that really for us, it's possible to determine virtually every experience of life as being a kind of continuum, where there is an extreme at one end and its opposite at the other. And if we strive for the abundant life that Jesus said he came that we might have, that concept in the Greek of perissos, the word that is used for abundant life, and if we want our lives to have a sense of wholeness and completeness, richness, fullness, then we need to find some midpath between these extremes and not avoid or deny the extremes. I don't mean that. Not that we decide that one extreme is good and the opposite extreme is not good, and we go for the extreme that we believe is good. Not that, but that we find very often that there's an awful lot of good in that which appears to be undesirable, and sometimes we have to be very careful that in that which appears to be very desirable, there's some stuff that isn't, in fact, all that desirable. And so we strive to find our own midpoint, our own balance, which oftentimes varies because we're not all the same, obviously. And so some of us are going to shake out, our midpoint will be closer to this extreme, maybe, or closer to that extreme. But it's going to be somewhere within a mid-range spread. We started out talking about, at the very first session, self-image. Our second one had to do with our shadows and our personas, and yesterday we talked about feelings, whether we are at the end where we suppress them and stuff them, or if we're at the end where we act out raw feelings very impulsively. So today we look at this whole matter of values, and again, I dramatized them by painting dramatic pictures of the two extremes, which I call simply, at one end, anything goes. Anything goes, whatever, all the way down to everything is black or white, and or white. That's the way you have to say it. You never say it at this extreme, everything is either black or white. You never say it that way. This extreme, you always emphatically pound the table or pound the pulpit or whatever your zone of communication is, and you say, look, there is an answer for everything. I have the answer, and it is either black or white. So, that's why I make no bones about calling it absolutism, that there is indeed an answer for everything. Here is where legalism comes into play, especially in family rearing situations where the environment is thou shalt and thou shalt not. There's no middle ground. There's never any gray. It's always black or white. Fixed rigidity, unalterable, no matter what. This is it. No matter what. There are no exceptions, John, Susie. Absolutely. No matter what. This is it. And so that ends up being really totalitarianism. Now you move all the way down to the other end of the continuum, and amorality is just to be without morals. You wonder, how can a person exist without morals? Well, people who are sociopathic, or as we used to call them, psychopathic, fit that category completely. Oftentimes, they think nothing of simply snuffing out a life and say, what's the big deal? Yeah, life is cheap. And what is very, very, very frightening is that that dimension of psychopathy really seems to be growing in our culture, especially in the drug culture, where life means nothing. Yeah.
I have to ask a question just to sort of get tuned into further what you're saying.
Yeah, I forgot to say again, this is a discuss-as-we-go course. And so you have to do just what you're doing and not hesitate to ask your questions so that we get to them, because we may not have time at the end. No, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm wondering if your two extremes, anything goes in black and white, are they anything parallel to or similar to this somewhat academic discussion sometimes of relativity and universalism, or cultural scientific relativism to universalism?
Sure.
Is that?
But we're going to be talking more in practical, everyday
terms. No, I understand.
That's right.
Oh yeah. Two as well, so.
Yeah, I come close to that with the absolutism, mm-hmm. Term. But no, that's right.
Okay.
So that. You also have the lawlessness or anarchy. Paul refers to that, that we have freedom in Christ, but that doesn't give us freedom for license. You have liberty, but that doesn't mean you have license, that you do whatever you wish. And this last one, of course, is the big seductive one for most of us in the whole developmental process. Follow the path of least resistance. Why not? All we do, any of you have done any trucking around the mountains at all, that's what water does. And water finally gets where it's going, and so there's a lot of arguments in favor of, why not? Follow the path of least resistance. We're going to get there. Well, it all depends on how many people you bowl over and how many situations you mess up in the process of getting there, if in fact there is where one really needs to get to. And so we launch off into this, looking at these two extremes and trying to find our way through to a mid-path in our value system, which every one of us has. Every human being has a value system. And you're going to say to me, but I thought you said the people who are amoral, sociopathic, psychopathic don't have any value systems. And that's right, that is their value system, that they have no values. And that's a valid value system. It's a terrible one and a very troublesome one, but nevertheless, it is a valid one. And Lord knows there are indeed lots and lots of people who have that. Some people talk and act as though they live by an absolute, unalterable value system, while others live and talk and act out in such a way that they are wild and rebellious and even sociopathic and seem to have absolutely no values whatsoever. Obviously, these people are very, very difficult to deal with. Most of them end up incarcerated. Oftentimes, they are identified as incorrigible. that they cannot change. I myself don't believe that. I think that there, I believe firmly that there is always the possibility of the opposite coming through, but it may take years and years and years and years of working with such a person. I've had the experience of having an opportunity to do that with a small handful, to see, especially adolescents in adolescent psychiatry, to see a 180 degree, a literal 180 degree turnaround over a long period of rehabilitation. But our society really isn't set up to deal adequately with the people who are over at this extreme, this absolute extreme of anything goes. Don't forget, this is a discuss as we go course. Now that I've remembered to say it, I'm probably going to say it more than I have to.
Is our society geared up to deal with the other extreme?
Well, our society isn't any better equipped to deal with that dimension, except that our society tends to be more accepting of that extreme. Much more accepting of that extreme. Even in its extreme. We would much rather have fanatic, let's pick on a religious fanatic, some religious fanatic who is identifying absolute blacks and absolute whites. Oh, we get bent out of shape by that, but we're not nearly as bent out of shape by that extreme as we are by the psychopath. So, and that's why I say there's a real seduction in all of these continuums that we're dealing with to determine that one is desirable and the other one is undesirable, and to eliminate the undesirable one and say have nothing to do with that whatsoever, and put our focus on the one that we have rather arbitrarily identified as the one extreme which is the more desirable. And I think we do that an awful lot in the organized church, much to our shortcoming, yeah.
Would that be because the black and white, while it's an extreme, you know where they're coming from, where the anything goes group, you can't
see where
they're coming from.
Yeah, that's scary. That's why people oftentimes fear emotionally disturbed people. In a sense, there are tours of everything under the sun. You can tour a bottling factory, you can tour a pottery, you can tour a place that makes shoes, but there never are any tours of the back wards of mental hospitals. No one is interested in going back there behind those locked doors, because everything is up for grabs. Anything goes, anything can happen. And one of the first things that you learn in dealing with severely emotionally disturbed people is to be sensitive to very, very slight changes. You also learn that if you work in prison settings, in correctional settings, that you're very, very sensitive to the very slightest change. And so that's, to answer at greater length than is probably necessary, that's true.
And will you be getting into more about the last thing on the anything goes, following the path of least resistance?
I can, if you want to hang on to it, and if I haven't satisfactorily dealt with it about 10 minutes before we're done, yell again and we'll come to it. The best way that I know of defining of what a value system is, since I've gone and made the blatant statement to say that every one of us has one, the best way that I know of defining or to describe a value system is through a series of questions. The number 10 is an arbitrary number, but it's a sacred number, and so that's why I picked on 10. 10 simple, but really very profound questions, and I'm going to read them to you slowly and let you just kind of savor them, because in my assessment, the answers to these simple but profound questions are the foundation of my value system. The first of the 10 questions is, what do you stand for? Now, admittedly, everybody's going to interpret stand for differently, and that's okay. I don't care how you interpret it. If it means one thing to you and something different to you and something different to me, that's okay. But a part of my value system, the very first thing that strikes me right between the eyes is, what do I really stand for? Okay. Did you have a question?
No.
Oh. The second one is, what do you believe in? And again, what does believe in mean, Bill? I don't know. What does it mean to you? Well, again, it means one thing here and another thing there and a third thing there. That's not important. What do you believe in? I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. Well, all right. So that's pretty simplistic, but nevertheless, that's what you believe in. That's okay. Three, is there anything for which you would lay down your life? Ooh. Now you're getting into the nitty-gritty. Now you're getting into the naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y stuff. Is there anything for which you would lay down your life willingly and say, I would die for that value? That means so much to me. Four, a little less, what is important to you? Now you can kind of come up for breath. And then number five, what is unimportant to you? What are the things that you really don't care about? You know, so somebody steps on an ant, so big deal. There are billions of ants, so what? Number six, what do you believe is the point or the purpose of life? Of life in general? Why are we running around on this planet? Why are we doing what we're doing? What's it all about anyway? What does God do as God sits upon God's throne and looks at this nonsense that is going on? Why? What's it all about anyway? What is the point? What is the purpose as you see it? And when you do this, you cannot allow yourself to be influenced by what other people think or say. That's why it's always necessary to do this little exercise totally on your own, so that you aren't wondering what am I doing what I ought to be doing? Am I where the majority are? We Americans are so stuck in that I have to underscore that. Because we are constantly asking ourselves, how am I shaping up with the next person? Rather than saying, okay, these are the things that I stand for, believe in, would die for, find important, find unimportant, etc. Number seven, what do you want to hold on to? Now that means both tangible and intangible stuff. What do you, and notice I say want to, what do you want to hang on to? One exercise that we sometimes do is, if your house were burning down and you knew, this is only a story of course, you knew that you had just 3 minutes to get out of it whatever you wanted, what would you go for? What do you want to hold on to? That of course is tangible stuff, but we're talking about not only tangible but intangible stuff too. I want to hold on to my marriage love. I want to hold on to the intimacy of parent to kid or whatever. Number eight, the converse of that, what are you willing to give up? What are you willing to let go of, to say bye-bye to? That's a hard one. That's a toughie, I think. Nine, this is a clever one. What do you choose to spend your time and energy on? What do you, and notice the choice of the words here, what do you choose to spend your time and energy on? Anytime I get into dealing with a person who is complaining about simply not enough time to do everything that she or he wants to do, I try to remind them that they have just as many hours as everybody else. Yes, but I have to do this and I have to do that. Let's see if the have to is in fact a have to
or if it's I want to, and I simply don't want to choose not to. We do, in fact, choose how we will use our time. That's the neat thing about Holden. We are pressed to make choices. How shall we use our time? Shall we come here and sleep in till 10? Why not? Shall we come here and get up and participate in everything that's on the agenda? Why not? How shall we choose to use our time? And the answer to that question is a real keynoter as far as what your value system looks like. And the last one, and I put it last because it's foundational, what are your religious beliefs? What are your religious beliefs, or faith beliefs, or spiritual beliefs? But you can't just respond to that and say, I am a spiritual person or a spiritual being. You've got to nail it down concretely and say, I believe this. So you sort of develop your own creed, your own credo. I believe. Now, even though there's only that 10th one that has the word religious or faith or spiritual in it, as far as I personally am concerned, this whole business is a spiritual exercise. Every one of these has its spiritual dimension, has its spiritual overtones, or is in fact a very, very spiritual kind of thing. And that collection of beliefs and principles and standards and qualities of just intrinsic base value importance, that stuff of meaning, that stuff of significance, that all put together is what makes up our value system. And looking at where we are on this continuum here, in my dealing with people, usually find them living closer to one of the extremes or the other than I find them in some kind of a midpoint or some kind of a balance point or a mid-path. In my limited experience, and it is limited, it seems to me that this is more true today, possibly, than ever before. We might have said in previous generations that, yeah, you can see where there would be an awful lot of people hanging around over here on the absolute side because of legalistic, rigid environments that people grow up in. But we didn't have too many people who were just off the wall, literally off the wall. That's not the case anymore. The case anymore is that there are as many people that I have to deal with, or that I choose to deal with, that are over in that area, closer to that extreme, which wasn't the case too long ago. And what happens, what is an interesting phenomenon, and we can quarrel about this together if you like, but one thing that I have observed is that these two seem to mutually encourage the advancement of each other. Do you know what I mean? Am I making any sense? That absolute black and white people, black or white people, seem to push people into the other extreme, into the anything goes, you know. I don't believe in anything. There is no such thing as values. And the people who are there in the anything goes, who are saying, I don't believe in anything, there's nothing of any value, seem to push other people then into a much more absolutist stance. Anytime you have a debate on an issue that has easily polarized dimensions to it, this happens. And each one kind of digs in for his or her extreme more. And in that digging in seems to enhance or encourage the other pole or the opposite. And that's not helpful at all. That is not promising at all. Because it's the converse of what we are about here today. Finding how are we going to bring these opposites together to some kind of of midpoint, recognizing that there are virtues and vices in each one of them. I got a hand first. Go ahead.
Why is that? Why do people become more close-minded as they're, because it is a deep value in them, or because it's so deep they just go more and more in one way than they hear some radical on the other side?
It is the, it's a combination of things. It is the disallowance, first of all, of opposites. Because in that, there's a certain threat. And again, we can quarrel about this, but my observation is that the more wobbly, more insecure one is in her or his position or posture, the more defensive she or he has to be in order to maintain that posture. Contrarywise, the more comfortable one is in his or her posture, the less defensive that person has to be, and the more open that person can be to the opposite, so that we can sit down and, as we say, reason together. So I think, at least that's my answer to your question of why these things happen. And what happens is that it escalates. It becomes a conflict situation where there very, very clearly then is a win-lose ending that is desired on both parts. If you're holding position A and I'm holding position B and I'm operating out of that wobbly stance, I'm going to hit you hard so that you go down, and you may go down, but you're going to come back up and hit me harder. And pretty soon then the guns are going to be out, and then the howitzers are going to be out, and then the big 12-inchers are going to be out, and pretty soon we'll be nuking each other. This happens pretty consistently in human interaction as well as in international interaction. Yes, sir, you had a question.
I guess my questions are more directed towards a group or a body of theories that look at things like moral development and along Kohlberg and Gilligan's lines and that type of thing, that both black and white thinking and relativity or anything goes kind of thinking is sometimes along the path of moral development before one actually ends up defining their own value system as a way of growing up. And they looked at college students and the progression that they go through in 4 or maybe 6 years of college, and a lot of them come in at a very young age with their world summed up in a black and white view, going through somewhere, so it's around their junior year, and they're going, well, this sort of relative thing, you know, anything goes seems to be really free and easy. But then they realize after that point, even after they get out of college, somewhere around 27 years old or so, that they come back to some of the values that they've had before, but justified through their own experience.
We have to talk about that because I accused this gentleman of looking at my notes yesterday. I'm going to accuse you of looking at them today.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because that's where we're going next. And that's good because it helps me to realize that we're pretty much on the track of where we want to go. I used to, some years ago, teach ethics to nursing school seniors when the hospital where I was employed had a school of nursing. And it was a full year-long course. I taught, it was a 3-year course in the hospital itself, wasn't a baccalaureate course. But the first year was theology for nurses, second year was psychology for nurses, and the third year was ethics. And I would begin the course with a battery of pretty naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, pretty naughty, tough ethical questions for practicing nurses. And I would simply, because they all knew who I was, because I'd had them for 2 years before, they knew what a rat I could be, I would go after them with these ethical issues and say, okay, now given this situation, this dilemma, what do you believe needs to be done? What is the right thing to do? And the student would respond, and I would just shoot all kinds of holes in that. And the student would be kind of dumbfounded. And so I would ask the next student, what's your response? And this student then, knowing that the one prior to her just been shot to pieces, would respond opposite, whether that was where she was coming or he was coming from or not. I guess it really was all she's. We didn't have then young men or men training for nursing. And I would do the same thing with that then, because it's really not that difficult to do, you know, to be a rat. It's kind of fun, in fact. No matter what you put up, I can shoot all kinds of holes in it. Even the devil could quote scripture, so that's no problem. And what would happen would be then that the students would get more and more unnerved and more upset and more distressed with me personally. And that was precisely what I was about. That was the motive. That was the point of it all. When we got through these things, they were just fit to be tied, and said, "You know, you're not fit to teach this class. You're not even fit to be an REV. How can you possibly do these things to us?" And then I would just glower at them and say, "Good. Now you're at a point where you're ripe, and I want to tell you that this is just the beginning. The whole year is going to be like this, and we're going to tangle hind ends, and we're going to cry, and we're going to scream and shout, and I'm going to push you and push you and push you until you say, 'I can't take any more of this nonsense. And what it's all about is this, that I stand here listening to you just kind of toss off quick, snappy responses to ethical issues that have the depth that none of us can really even see down into. And you have that. And because one says the answer is A, the next one says the answer is B, because I said, no, A is wrong. Well, we're going to spend this whole year, and I'll tell you at the end of the year, you are going to end up with a value system that is yours. I don't know where you got these values. I don't know where they came from. They come from mama, daddy, pastor, some wall hanging, advertising somewhere, or a book you read, or whatever. But I can pretty well guarantee you that by the end of this year is over, your value system is going to be yours, because we are going to have struggled and fought and wrestled and sweat and cried and bled. And you will know where you stand. I don't care. It may be exactly where you are today. There was a time in my life when I believed that if everybody believed as I believed, it would be a much better world. But I'm not here, I would say, to convert you into Bill Millers. I am here to help you become the value person that you are, so that by the time we're finished, what you hold in your system is going to be yours. Now that's work, see? That's hard to do, and that takes time to do. And they would resist, just as I would resist, just as any one of us would resist, with anyone who would challenge a value system. We could get into a real knockdown drag-out right here in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. And we could become very defensive with each other and get into all kinds of heated quarrels and discussions. But probably many of us would leave having done a little bit of re-evaluating. We ordinarily don't do this, you see. Because it's not the easiest thing in the world. It's much easier to take the value and run. I came across a fellow one time whose life really got into jeopardy because he had never evaluated his value system. He grew up in a marvelous home up in north of Boston, up on the North Shore. And he is, now we must end at 10 minutes before the hour, mustn't we? Is that right? Yeah, okay, so I keep my bearings here. Very, very helpful family, the mother and father, especially his mother. Taught him real integrity. And he went into business finance and did very well at that, got a master's degree and worked first of all, a restaurant chain up there, and then he moved into a trucking company. And I forget when he came to Minnesota, but that was when I first met him, though, in Minneapolis. He was extremely despondent, was in situational depression, and his marriage was wobbly. He had been out of work for 5 months and was just kind of going down the downward spiral of despondency and despair. And what had happened was that in the company where he worked at this particular time, up to 5 months ago, he worked as CFO, Chief Financial Officer. And it was his responsibility to prepare the material for the annual report that went out to the stockholders the CEO, the chief executive officer, said to him, Harvey, this is the way I want you to put the figures together this year. And Harvey said, but that's not accurate. And his boss said to him, accurate, schmaccurate, you're going to put them together the way I tell you. It wasn't that it was a matter of illegality. He wasn't telling him to do anything illegal, but Harvey knew that to present the figures of the previous fiscal year in the way the CEO wanted him to would give an inflated impression. It would not be an accurate impression of the company's financial status. And so Harvey said, I'm not going to do that. And the boss said, you're going to do what I tell you or you're out. And so Harvey said, in that case, then, goodbye. And he left his job with nothing to go to. And something got hold of him, and he didn't know what it was. Something that disallowed him to be his, as he would phrase it, old self. He applied for many, many positions. He had headhunter leads and everything, and every one of them turned out to be, well, it's nice, but we'll call you. Don't call us. So that he got into negative thinking, finally, you know, that system where you're selling pots and pans from door to door, and your customer comes to the door and you say, you really don't want to buy any pots today, do you, sir? In essence, that was the way he was presenting himself. You really don't want to hire me, do you? So what we did was to go back, and I tell you the truth, I do not remember how we got together. But anyway, we went back and took a look at some of his roots in this whole developmental process, because this is, as you're pointing out, is where so much of this takes place. And he said, the thing that I remember most about my mother was the honesty, the clear honesty, the integrity of honesty, and something that she said to me that I'll never forget. She said, Harvey, what you do, the way to make it in this world, to fulfill your responsibility as a valuable human being, is you go to work for a company, and you start low, and you work your way up, and you spend a good 50 years with them, and then you retire, and they give you a gold watch. Now, that sounds right. Sounded right to her. Sounded right to Harvey. But that hadn't happened for him. He hadn't stayed with the same company. It hadn't bothered him before he left the last one, because in his unconscious, he really hadn't left a company. He was moving from one company to another, where he moved up the corporate ladder with broader responsibility and greater financial reimbursement for that. Nothing had really broken this value of working diligently for a company for the 50 years and get the gold watch, until he left the job with nothing to go to. And this old value of his mother was the thing that was driving him down. I'm a not good person because I will now never fulfill that value, which wasn't his at all, but was his mother's. But he'd never taken any time to process that. He'd never taken the time to say, yeah, when my mother and dad were young and first got married, that was the ideal thing. That's what you did. You got into some company and you worked for, well, maybe 40 years or whatever, and you retired and they gave you the gold watch, and that was it. And as a young boy, that sounded good to him, and so he just kept it and hung on to it. Never, ever processed it. Never took a look at it to see if it even made any sense. It didn't make any sense in the 80s. It may have made sense in the 40s, or certainly earlier. But here was a situation where his value system was both very, very helpful, very integrative in terms of his personal integrity, but destructive in terms of this particular value that was going to drive him right down into depression. So once he could see that this value that he held so dearly wasn't his own, but was his mother's, he could let it go. And that's exactly what he did. This story has a happy ending, because what he ultimately did was start up his own consulting firm and I sort of facetiously said to him one day, well, you give yourself a gold watch after a few years if you still want to hang on to that. Where do value systems come from? Well, holy mackerel. What you do is go back and review your answers to those 10 questions, and you say, where did those answers come from? Did I sit down one day and think up, you know, what I stand for? Did I sit down one day and decide what I would die for? Did I sit down one day and decide what I really want to hang on to and what I could let go of? You have to, and this of course takes time. Where did I get this value? Oh, I remember, I read a book once when I was in 11th grade. I remember very clearly. Some philosopher, I forget his name, but I was very impressed with this at the moment. And so that became a part of my value system. Now I take a look at it today and I say, that was interesting. That was great when I was in the 11th grade. I don't think that fits me today. But I have to do that consciously. Otherwise, that value will be a governor. It will be a guide in my life. That's what our value systems are. But I say, to take the time to do that, well, we are busy people. We have so many things to do. Places to go, people to see, etc., etc., etc. And so we rationalize and say, I'll do it tomorrow, or I'll do it maybe next year, or I'll just take a week off sometime and I'll evaluate my value system on that one. We get them from parents, we get them from teachers, we get them from relatives, playmates and peers, our family heritage. Oh boy, do we get a lot from our family heritage. Wow. So many of us who are counselors or therapists are dealing with people whose family heritage said to them, in the Miller family, we never seek help. We work out our own issues because we are strong people. We do not need these outsiders to help us with our problems. Thank you. So that becomes a powerful value in the lives of people who grew up in that kind of an atmosphere, where mom and dad made no bones about the fact that you don't tell anybody else your troubles, boy, girl. You don't tell anybody else your troubles. You keep it right here. You work out your own problems. Or big boys don't cry, or little girls don't play with trucks. Family heritage. Our nationality. We carry in a lot of values just by virtue of whatever we happen to be nationality-wise. Our socioeconomic class, our faith system. Boy, oh boy, do we ever have a lot of values implanted by Sunday school teachers, Sunday church school teachers. You know what one of the most profound ones is? Has to do with self-image. How sometimes Sunday school teachers would say to kids when they were going, now be good this week so God will love you. Innocent, my foot. Here it develops a value in these kids that God loves you when you are good. Contrary-wise, if you are not good, God doesn't love you. And in our heart of hearts, every one of us knows that we are not all that good. You know, Sunday school kids can't wait to act out their nastiness. I mean, they're hardly even dismissed from the class before they're into it. And kids are not dumb. Kids know what I always liked Red Skelton's mean little kid, that one characterization that he did. That's the image I have of this, that a kid knows full well that he or she is going to act out and be naughty rather than nice. So what does that mean? Well, okay, no kid sits around and contemplates that, or rather very few do. But the seed is there, the seed is planted, and it grows. So that this is a value, this is a dimension. And I maintain it can be a very, very destructive one that will work against a healthy, positive development of a self-image that is pleasing to us and certainly pleasing to God. I think that those of us who are teachers, many of us do realize the responsibility that we have, but there are great, great, great many who do not realize the responsibility that we have as teachers, whether it be in religious settings or secular settings, public school, private school, whatever. We have we have such a wonderful privilege to function as teachers. And we've really got to realize the responsibility that we carry too. How about people say, I got lesson plans to prepare, I got this, that, and the other thing. You know, I can't worry about what kind of values I'm implanting in kids that I deal with. That's unfortunate. And you move over into the world of media, into television, movies, songs, novels. That's a biggie. Yes?
You know, isn't it also unfortunate that, you know, our roles as teachers, many times we forget that the critical facilities of the children, fostering them so they can actually look at a value and analyze it. And without that function, evaluating your values is impossible.
Sure.
And many times in education, this is my area of studies, mm-hmm. education, is that it's not happening.
Right? Sure. Yeah.
And kids come through a system with pegging along values. I mean, we're looking at astronomical divorce rate. You know, values for families have been shattered in a lot of senses for these children sometime when they've been in school. They come out, and how do they evaluate that? Except for being plain confused. Their self-image is tossed to the wind.
You're talking about is one of the reasons I see why there's a growing number of people down at that end.
Mm-hmm.
Because the abnormal in our culture and society is slowly becoming the norm. When you're talking about single-parent families, you're talking about 50%, half and half.
I think as teachers, we're seeing more and more on this end.
They just don't care. The kids are seeing
this. Anything goes.
In the kids. Mm-hmm. I think we're seeing more and more kids on this end of it.
Yeah, I have a lot of teacher friends, and they tell me that teaching now isn't what it was 10 years ago.
Would you say that related to rapid change in culture and all across the board, society, real fast rate of change lately as opposed to several decades ago?
I wrote down here in my notes in a healthy way, the only thing certain is uncertainty, and the only constant is change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can take that in a negative way, you know, and say, but I'm saying that's what needs to drive us to realize a flexibility of values. Because of the change in our culture and society, which is so rapid, it's not an arithmetic thing, it's a geometric thing. It goes up like that.
Yeah.
And I really don't know. In my more cynical moments, I get very frightened and say, I don't know what to look for next. It can be very, very frightening.
Isn't it worthwhile to take a look at the media, just television, for example, and ask yourself what the values are that are being expressed typically in programming?
Yes.
And look at the difference just in the last 10 years, 10, 15 years.
Right. Yeah, it's probably the last decade. Yeah, the 80s.
But those values seem like they're not just being expressed, they're actually being marketed. I mean, they're being pushed rather than onto some very young minds that are incapable of extracting out the fact that, it's getting pushed on them as a value. Mm-hmm. I think that's dangerous. I think it's dangerous for both ends of this continuum.
Well, we can talk about that too. The point of evaluating the values is that there probably needs to be some kind of an intervention because we normally don't do it. We simply don't pause and sit down and say, what are my answers to these 10 questions? And we do change. Our systems do change. We have indeed certain basic foundational stuff that does not change, that dare not change. That's Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Our basic foundation of a spiritual dimension of our lives does not change. But what would be interesting to me, and I wish I had done this, I wish I had enough sense back when I was a younger man, I wish I had a written out answer to this series of questions when I was age 20, 30, 40, and 50. and what I'll have in a few months when I do it at age 60. And see the modulation over those years. I look simply at one basic element, and that is time. Look into your own experience of life and see if perhaps at age 20 my evaluation of time would have been rather insignificant. Like, what's the big deal? We've got tons and tons of time. Time is no big deal. And now, at almost age 60, it goes way up on the scale of values, so the time is very, very precious. And I don't really know if I would take time to look through the spectrum of values that I have now at age 60 or almost 60. I could use that as a base to look back, but then again, you're always jaundiced by retrospection, and so I don't know how accurate that would be. I wish really that I had done that, just to see the shift, the change. Because one of the interesting things about second half of life is that we do experience a lot of value shifts. Because the first half of life is a very hectic period of time where we're shooting out and going after this and going after that and everything. We have to make it in a thousand different ways. Second half of life is a much more mellow one, where what were important, dreadfully important things in the first half of life, now in the second half of life, don't seem to be all that important or demanding of us. Do I still hold to values that I once had, but do not espouse any longer? And if we're in a situation where we have not evaluated our values, sometimes the conflict within us can be very profound. For instance, if a tragic situation comes into my life and I am not clear on what are my values and what were the values that were given to me that I never processed, I really don't know how to interpret this. Is this just a strong wind that's coming in, or is it actually a tornado that's going to sweep me off somewhere? And I have discovered that this is one of the ways that stress piles upon stress. If I get myself into a stressful situation, I may be there because of a response to a value which wasn't mine. Have you ever heard people say, I don't like doing this, but I have to do it? Or I rather, I would really enjoy doing such and such, but I just can't allow myself to do it. And what is at the root of all that is a value which comes from some outside source and which is not my own. And I'm constantly dealing with that within people whose lives are governed by other people's values, most often those of parents that they grew up with, and who are in stressful situations not knowing how to evaluate the situation. Am I making any sense in this? Because it's a real profound sort of thing.
Your example of your CEO or CFO,
uh-huh,
is exactly that.
Okay.
He had those values that came from his mother.
Right.
And his stressful situation was his boss was telling him to go against those.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't able to interpret where are these values coming from,
right,
that is giving me the stress.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly, you know, we can make any kind of hypothetical case, mm-hmm, of what would have happened, mm-hmm, if he'd done it. You know, we would have liked that maybe if he did do this and he realized that these weren't his values, and then he established his values, he may have come back to his boss, maybe they came up with some kind of a compromise,
mm-hmm,
that,
yeah,
was worked out, that gave the CEO what he wanted, mm-hmm, and the CFO still felt his values were intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, for him, it didn't happen, turned out to be a stress on stress kind of thing. It's tough enough when we're caught in those situations to deal with them. If we don't know where we stand, or if we're standing on somebody else's ground, then that's what I mean by the stress on stress. Yes, sir?
Isn't the change of one's values more of a subconscious change you know, you're a product of your environment. Somebody raised in the Depression has a different basic set of values than somebody that was raised in the 50s or the 60s.
Right.
And if you experience a significant event that affects your life, I think it's more of a subconscious shift. And you don't stop and think that, hey, I'm changing my value now from this to this.
Yeah, and that's an unfortunate thing whenever it's unconscious, because there isn't anything we can do about that. That's one point I'm going to keep hammering away at these both these weeks.
But it's an inherent part of your life.
I know, but you're not allowed to just say that that's the case. You can say it, of course, if you want, but that does not allow us to proactively deal with the issues of our lives. I can say, but it's the product of the Depression. That's the way I think. I'm stuck in that. And that's governed me in many, many ways. And I sometimes would choose to use that as a rationalization for some of the things. And I'm not saying that's bad. All I'm saying is that the more we are aware of ourselves and understand ourselves, the more we can be in control of our lives and our destinies. Yes, ma'am.
Adults who have never questioned their parents' black and white values, that can have devastating effects, as you're saying. But is it possible that there are more and more kids over on that side because their parents haven't given them any values?
Yeah.
And so when, well, it's hard being a parent. Because you don't choose values out of a vacuum.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday, that's probably the greatest challenge of parenthood, that whole business of
helping. You give them values, but question me while I'm giving you the values.
Oh, yeah. And kids in the whole process of development are constantly pushing the limits. How far can I push it? And we look back, and unless you are extraordinary people, I bet every one of us wanted to push the limits as far as we could. And we were all bent out of shape whenever some authority said, no way, thus far shalt thou go, and there shall thy proud waves be stayed. And we didn't like that at all. But one of the interesting things about working in adolescent psychiatry is that one of the most helpful things for these troubled young people is to establish limits. And while they will fight tooth and nail against the limits, ultimately, when they are in the healing process, are gracious, are very grateful for the limits that were established. And so that's why I say the job of parenting is a great challenge. And we pray a lot, and we hope a lot, and we believe that we will do the best we possibly can, and then we leave the rest in the hands of the Spirit of God and say, go for it, O Spirit. That's about the turf that I wanted to cover this afternoon. We're on a pretty good time. We might have a minute or two for one or two more observations or comments. Yes, sir.
Back to the last item, to follow the path of last resistance.
Following the path of least resistance. Would you like me to say a little more about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a part, I would say, of our human perversity. Why make it, whatever it is, any harder than it has to be? And one of the ways that is lived out in the current generation is the immediacy issue. Have it now. No concept of delayed gratification. That's one of the toughest problems that we're dealing with. And that along with the concept of trade-off and the concept of prioritizing, those are the three, when we talk about values, the three key issues that we prioritize whenever there's any kind of conflict. Because values are going to conflict. There's no question about that. It's not, living life is not a piece of cake. Values are going to conflict, and we have to understand, we may have to prioritize them. We may have to get into trade-offs. If two values come head-on, I cannot be at two places at the same time. That's a physical impossibility. I have to trade one thing off for the other, and the third one is delayed gratification. And following the path of least resistance flies right in the face of delayed gratification. And so that again, I see as one of the key reasons for what we're talking about, why there are so many young people over on this one. Follow the path of least resistance. People getting into drug activity, that's the motto. Where there is not a value for academic achievement, squeak by. Sometimes I think in the world of work here in this country, because of our just inexcusably low rate of productivity, do the least you can for the greatest amount of pay. That seems to be the motto. Now, you could say, come on, Miller, you're really up on a soapbox preaching now. Knock it off. Maybe I am. I don't know. But I think that has some pretty far-reaching ramifications that follow in the path of least resistance.
I'm thinking, too, something you mentioned earlier about the win-lose mindset, that in some ways I see that as being a path of least resistance.
Oh,
It's very obvious where, like, I'm thinking interdependence and being able to be flexible enough to keep my schedule to hear your view.
Right.
It's time.
And work and energy.
Yeah, so
absolutely.
A lot of decisions that get made, policy, et cetera, I think it's easy to get with that. I win or lose versus, well, how can we work together?
Right. Well, yes.
Are we going to talk about how, for example, there are a lot of things, as I mentioned before, a lot of things on the media that I prefer not having on the media.
Right.
Not having on television, for example. Particularly in commercials. But are we going to talk about what directions people can take to change that kind of situation? Is there a possibility of changing the media's mindset about what to present?
We don't, unfortunately, have time now to do it. I'm not sure where we could. Or we could do it, but yes, we are not powerless. Just quick off the top of my head, the best way is to write to the chief executive officer of the company sponsoring whatever the program is or whatever the commercial is. And you can get that from the library. You can write directly to the president or the chairman of the board, chairperson of the board. What my own personal opinion is that greed is the culprit behind it all. The greed is the pull. It's where it is really all coming from, and that may be a simplification. I'm not sure, a reductionist simplification, but I think it's pretty accurate that reducing everything down, the bottom line is greed. The, as we say in America, the almighty buck.
Is that a value, greed?
Greed is the perversion of a value. Yeah. Greed and avarice are an extreme of reasonable ambition, I would say. If you put naive philanthropy at one extreme and avarice at the other extreme, we're looking for some midpoint, which would be reasonable ambition, let's say.
So a person who had values saying that I should be doing good for other people, not myself, but